Okay, so it's nice to be here at the KITP again. I want to thank the organizers for organizing the nice conference and also the workshop before. For me, it's kind of the ending of the summer. I started the summer with a conference where I was giving the first lecture in the first day, and now I'm giving the last lecture in the last day, so I know it's over. And have to go back to teaching on Monday. So, okay, so the subject of the talk is going to be field correlations and entanglement, and it's going to be a bit an unusual way of thinking about the electromagnetic field in matter. So let me give a brief outline. Oops. So I'll start with an introduction, just since there's a very very varied crowd here. I'll talk a bit about entanglement and what is entanglement entropy and why we care about these things. And then I'm going to switch gears and go into my own personal obsession with understanding what the electromagnetic field does. And so we are going to talk about what an electromagnetic field does in a dielectric, and in which sense it is entangled with the dielectric, and what is the state of this electromagnetic field. And I will talk about the cutoff dependence of the entropy of the field, and I will talk about what I define as a kind of Casimir entanglement entropy, which is the analog of Casimir energy, but talking about entanglement entropy. So let me begin with a quick review. So when we're talking about entanglement, we always have in mind two systems, say A and B. And when we say that the system is entangled, we mean that we cannot write a wave function for the entire system as a product function. We can diagonalize this wave function and write it in a Schmidt basis. And using that, we can define reduced density matrix. So a reduced density matrix of a part of a system, like A here, carries all the information we have about measurements of observables in A. And if you want, this is an alternative definition. A density matrix of A is something that will give us all of the expectation values of observables localized in A. This is actually the proper way of defining a reduced density matrix. And once we have a reduced density matrix, if the state is not pure, we can talk about, say, the entropy of the state. This is just the von Neumann entropy, or any other kind of measure of how far the state is from being pure. Okay, so let's talk a bit about features of these things. So so in a condensed matter, from a condensed matter point of view, these are the main features of this entanglement of condensed matter in condensed matter systems. So in one dimension, it's kind of easy to understand. When we have a block of a system and we want to ask questions about scaling of entanglement, then we always know that any interesting correlations are always a boundary effect. They come from the boundary. And so we expect that as the size of the systems become larger than the correlation length, the entropy, we cannot get any more interesting correlations into the system. And so entropy stops growing and it saturates in one dimension. So this understanding, of course, is correct as long as we are not at the critical point where suddenly correlation length becomes infinite. So indeed, when we sit in a critical point, turns out that entropy tends to diverge logarithmically. This is a particular model, the Ising model. But this is a general feature. Many, many people, including some that sit here, have worked on this. The main feature of systems in one dimensions which are critical is that the scaling is logarithmic, and it is proportional to the conformal charge of the system. And this is, so we like it because it has kind of universality flavor for it. We can characterize many, many different systems with the same kind of, with just one number. In higher dimensions, we have the same, maybe before higher dimensions, why we care about this from a practical point of view. So, so from a practical point of view, we care about it because of simulations. So whenever we want to do simulate something like a spin chain, we want to see how effective are methods like density matrix renormalization group in simulating such a system. And it turns out that the measure of basically the size of the, well, the size of the effective matrices we have to keep track of scales with basically the same way as the exponent of the entropy. So in one dimension, if the entropy saturates, we can simulate systems very well, keeping only a finite number of degrees as we, what are called the bond dimensions, as we make the system larger and larger. And even if the system is critical, since the exponent of a log is still linear, we can simulate even critical systems in one dimension. Now, in higher dimensions, situation is not as nice. The same understanding that I think was put forward by maybe by Sladnitsky is that whenever we have a system, since we get entropy from correlations between our system and whatever is outside, then we're going to get an area law. So always the entropy will scale like the boundary between our region and whatever is outside. And this is certainly true for systems with finite correlation lengths. If the system has longer correlations, like this case that we worked out for free fermions, it turns out that there are corrections and entropy can scale faster. But in general, the rule is entropy always comes from correlations and from between our system and whatever it's outside. And well, if the boundary measures how much correlations there are, then we have scaling that goes like the boundary. Now, so these are general things, and probably most of you have heard about this in one way or another. And now let me try and understand these kind of things in quite a different context, and that is of radiation and matter. So there are a few works talking about the entanglement of radiation and matter, but they are, as you shall see, quite different from what I'm going to talk about. They are kind of dual works. So one is this this work about entanglement in the Dicke model, where effectively what I have is many, many spins interacting with just one mode of the radiation field. And these gentlemen were interested in how does the entanglement between this field, this one mode, and all of these spins behaves as I go through a phase transition, the super radiance phase transition in the Dicke model. Of course, it turns out that the entropy diverges. Another case of talking about entanglement of radiation and matter was discussed by Becker and Lahoux. And there, it's kind of exactly the opposite scenario. You have one spin. And so this is the spin boson model. You have one spin, and it's talking with a whole bunch of harmonic oscillators. So the harmonic oscillators are the radiation. And again, the interest here is more about a phase transition between the single spin being basically localized or not. Now, what I'm going to talk about is basically infinitely many spins, if you want, talking to infinitely many modes of the electromagnetic field. And I want to think about it like this. So the problem I want to consider is I just have, it's a typical physics scenario. I have a dielectric. I have a field that lives there. And I want to ask, what is the state of this field? So let me set this question up. So I'm always looking at some kind of long-range, low-momenta properties of the field. And I'm going to describe everything in terms of an effective description of the medium. I don't want to go into particularities of what the medium does. I don't even know. And I want to describe everything in terms of the dielectric function, which summarizes for me the medium. So let's just write the Maxwell equation. I'm going to work in radiation gauge. A naught is zero, and d is the usual d. I assume that there are no sources, no free charges, or anything like that, and we can write the Maxwell equation in terms of the vector potential A, like this. So here we are not doing anything fancy, like we've seen yesterday that you can make two photons interact and so on. Here it's just a low energy kind of ground state electromagnetic field. Everything is linear. The electromagnetic field is assumed to be a Gaussian. And basically, we can compute all the field correlations from just using Wick's theorem. And let me just tell you the way I want to approach it. So I want to think about this Maxwell equation as coming from an action, which will allow me to afterwards do all of my calculations. So this will be the action. So I have two polarization modes in free space. And if you look at the equation, just the Maxwell's equation that we had before, you see it's k squared plus omega squared epsilon of omega. This comes from this kind of action. Right? Once I have the action, it allows me immediately to compute all of the correlation functions by just inverting this thing here, integrating over frequencies. And I think about this effective action as coming out of integrating out some matter degrees of freedom, the dipoles in the material, and so forth, and defining for me, after I integrate over, say, the material psi, I have some effective action from A. And so life is good. Let's compute. Well, once you start doing it, you immediately run into a problem that was kind of surprising for me, and I want to tell you about it. It's kind of elementary, but I found it very confusing in the beginning. And the point is the following. Let's say you have a field, and you have an effective like action like this. It allows you to compute all the correlators and so on. But in fact, it doesn't specify the state of the field. So an action by itself, if it is an effective action, is not enough to specify, to quantize the field, if you want. And this means that I wrote this. I can compute all the correlation function, but I still don't know really the quantum state of the electromagnetic field. It's kind of surprising. So let me tell you how to understand it. And the way to understand how to quantize is to go back to where the action came from. But let me explain this point with a, let's just consider a scalar field. It's kind of a surprising thing about path integrals, or, well, surprising to those who, like me, who haven't thought about it until they had to. So think that you have a field, radiation field, and a matter field, and they have some simple Lagrangian, like a harmonic oscillator of phi, harmonic oscillator of psi, and some coupling term. We can easily integrate out psi, and we will get an effective action for phi, right? So we just write this in frequency domain, omega psi phi. We integrate out psi. We get this. Basically, this is some kind of a susceptibility that attaches to phi. If we started with a different Lagrangian, where instead of putting the dot, instead of doing psi dot phi, I would do psi phi dot, I will do the canonical way of computing effective action, I will get exactly the same effective action. And classically, these two Lagrangians are exactly the same. Right? They are related by a total derivative. Quantum mechanically, they are not. They are related by a unitary transformation. So both of them give me the same effective action, but they are not the same Hamiltonian. How do you see that? If you look at any evolution with such a Hamiltonian between some field configuration, one field configuration and another, then, well, if you use L1, you will do a path integral using L1. And if you do, you check what is the difference in the integrating L1 and L2, it's just this boundary term. So you can see that the if you use L1 for your quantization, the result that you will get is basically different from what you will get by L2 by this boundary term, which is basically a unitary transformation. Now, the point is that this unitary transformation, if you want to talk about entanglement, say, between phi and psi, this unitary transformation mixes phi and psi. So it changes the entanglement. So if I want to, want to ask something? Yeah. Right. Well, the effect is in that you mix phi and psi. Okay, so the point here is the following. We had an effective action for phi. What I'm trying to explain is that phi, the effective action itself does not define anything because I need boundary conditions. And so, all I'm saying is that this describes the same physics, right? In a sense, when we think about it classically. But now we have to worry about the fact that this canonical transformation mixes phi and psi, if you want. Yeah, if you want, yeah. But the equation, the classical equation of motion will be the same, basically. Okay. So let me continue with this. I should continue in the right direction. How does this manifest itself in quantum electrodynamics? So there's this nice transformation, it's called powers in our Woolley transformation, that takes you between two well-known Hamiltonians of the electromagnetic field in material. One is has a form that goes like A dot J, the other one is E dot P. As you can see, well, since E is just A dot, right, and P is just, J is that P, just P dot, this is exactly this kind of transformation. So the Powers-Denau-Woolley transformation is exactly this unitary transformation that mixes the dipole degrees of freedom with the field degrees of freedom. And we have to decide about our effective action, where it came from, because we'll get different results otherwise. So I'm going to go ahead and say that we start with an A dot J coupling, and this will, for me, will be enough to actually use the effective action and tell you what is the state of the field. I can skip that. If you want to have a Hamiltonian in mind, it's just a typical, photon-phonon Hamiltonian. We'll skip it. So let me just summarize. We have a Hamiltonian, we have an effective action now that looks like this. So the dielectric function just enters here. We compute all correlations by the usual rules of computing correlations, and we will assume that the conjugate momentum to phi, which is like the field E in the Weyl gauge, is just phi dot. So E is A dot, if you want. Once we assume this, it allows us to compute everything about the fields because we can now compute not only field correlators, but also field momenta correlators. And that is the all information about the field that we need. So let me first say give you a trivial example. So a trivial example is take epsilon, which is independent of omega. If epsilon is independent of omega, that somehow means that we didn't really need the material to get this kind of an action. We could actually use a Hamiltonian, and we could interpret this action as coming from a Hamiltonian and conclude that there is no entropy. So the entropy comes from the fact that epsilon is non-local in time. And what I'm going to try and tell you about is how this comes in. So here is a brief, well, a crash course on how to compute things. So since we are dealing with a Gaussian field, all we need to know are two-point functions. So two-point functions, we can summarize them. So there are reviews. Actually, Jens here has a nice paper on this. There is a canonical way of dealing with Gaussian states. All you need to do is compute correlation functions, including momentum and field correlation functions. We bunch them, all of the coordinates and momenta, we bunch them together. What we do, we write this covariance matrix gamma. We find the transformation that diagonalizes this gamma while maintaining commutation relations. This is called the symplectic transformation. And after this symplectic transformation, the covariance matrix becomes diagonal with these lambdas being the values on the diagonal. Now, once we have these lambdas, we can write the field density matrix in terms of these lambdas, and we compute whatever information we want about the field. So the only thing maybe to remember is the following. Lambda squared are eigenvalues of basically a product of the field correlation functions and momentum correlation functions. This is the only thing to remember here. And so once we have the lambdas, we can compute the entropy. There's like standard formulas for this. And now let's see how it works in the simplest example I could write, and where the result should better be that we have zero entropy. And this is the free field. So take a free field. So this is maybe the most convoluted way of getting that the entropy of the free field is zero. But on the other hand, we can generalize it to more complicated actions. So consider an action for this free field. And what we are going to do, everything is diagonal in momentum, so we can compute things in momentum space. The correlators in momentum are just 1 over the, so we integrate over frequency, 1 over omega squared plus k squared. This is an easy integral that goes like 1 over k. The correlators of the momenta go like k squared over omega squared plus k squared. And again, I'm integrating over omega. The result is just k times what I got here. So if I multiply this and this, what I get is, well, in the appropriate units, is 1. And this is independent of k. And when you plug it in the formula for the entropy, which was this thing, this lambda turns out to be 1 for all k's, and h of 1 is just 0. So entropy is 0 for the free field. OK, that's good. We can do another thing that will give us zero entropy, and that's use a pure plasma model for the dielectric, where I just take the dielectric to be some constant plus something that goes like 1 over omega squared. When I plug this in my action, I get just an action of a free field, but with an additional mass term. This can also come from just a usual Hamiltonian, and I can quantize this and get zero entropy. But now, what happens if I take a more typical dielectric function? So here is what happens. So let's take a dielectric function like this. This is really a typical form. I have this 1 over, so this is on the real axis. I do all of the calculation on the imaginary axis, but this is the typical form for a dipole interacting with the field. And we do this calculation I told you about. We compute the correlation functions in K. We multiply them and find this symplectic angle values lambda. Once you plug it in here, let me plot how this coefficients that sit here look like when I write the density matrix. So here is a plot for different values of this coupling constant omega p. What you can see immediately from this, you can see that the state of the field is not thermal. This is not a thermal state of a quantum electromagnetic field, because we would usually would expect to have a linear dispersion, and the energies should go like k. So since this is not linear in k, this is not a thermal state. You could kind of think that there is basically different temperatures, one for low k's and another one somehow asymptotically for large k's. These are more details. So at low k's, it turns out that these coefficients go like square root of k. Nk is the occupation number, average occupation number of a k-mod, goes like 1 over square root of k. And the effective temperature, if you want, if you would assume that the non-perturbed energies should be linear in k, the effective temperature actually at small k's diverges as 1 over square root of k, which is kind of strange, but that's what you get. I should at this point maybe make a remark that this is for a dielectric. For a metal, the things are a bit different, because there it now becomes important to keep track of the k dependence of the dielectric function in the some of this. This divergence seems to go away when you're talking about the metal. Another thing that is kind of curious is, in one dimension, if you measure, if you count the average number of excited modes, not the average number, but the variance in the excited modes, you find that it actually has an infrared divergence, but not that the entire system has an infrared divergent of number of low k's, but that the divergence is per unit volume. So it's very strange. And I don't really know how to interpret that. That's what comes out of the calculation. Okay. How about the cutoff dependence? For that, we have to go and look at the asymptotics of this symplectic eigenvalues at large momenta. You find that indeed, as you would expect, the entropy diverges. Lambda is some high momenta cutoff, and the entropy diverges as some power of the logarithm of the cutoff. This is the entropy per unit volume in the system. Okay, so now let me jump to the next part, which is saying the following. Okay, we have a divergent entropy, and we want to ask, is there anything universal, or is there anything that we can find which is doesn't care about this divergence? And in a philosophy similar to what one does in the Casimir effect, we're going to look at differences between entropies of different bodies. And we are going to, so let me set it up maybe like this. So now I'm going to make the problem slightly more complicated. Instead of a homogeneous space, I'm going to look at two bodies, A and B, and the free. The same way as we do in the Casimir effect, we compute the energy of the field in the presence of these two bodies. We remove self-energies of the bodies, and we are left with something that only depends on the relative positioning of the bodies. And so the derivative of the energy with respect to this relative positioning is what we call the Casimir effect. You can do the same thing with entanglement entropy. You can compute the entanglement entropy of the field in the presence of this body, in the presence of that body, and in the presence of both of them, and look at the part which only depends on the relative positioning. So let me maybe skip this. There was actually, believe it or not, an experimental motivation for this problem. If you would want, I'll tell you in the end. So this is the object I'm going to look at. So I have two bodies, A and B. I'm going to look at the entropy of the field after I integrate out A and B, minus the entropy of the field after I integrate out A, minus the entropy of the field after I integrate out B. And then I would hope that this result is actually finite. I want to say maybe just words for those of you who are interested in this kind of stuff. This relative Casimir entropy is not relative entropy. It's not the same thing. I'm not looking at a situation where I integrate out different parts of the system and asking about the relative information that I lose. Here I'm comparing different systems, one with only body A, one with only body B, and one with both of them. So this entropy that I consider, well, this is basically a very different quantity from a relative entropy in the information theory sense. Okay, this is complicated, so I'll skip that. And I'll just, since I don't have a lot of time, I will just tell you what one can compute. So now we're interested in computing some kind of a difference between entropies like that and to ask how it scales with difference between bodies. And I'm going to look, so the entanglement entropy turns out to be a bit hard. There is a, when you can't do something which is hard, you you invent reasons why it's very important to do something which is much easier. And in this case, we are going to compute the second Reni entropy, which is just log of the trace of the density matrix square. And this has much nicer analytic properties, so we can compute stuff. Here is an explicit formula for this entropy. The relative, after you did all of the subtractions, it's given as a trace log of a bunch of operators. The operators are just the product of the field correlators and momentum correlators, and you subtract from them the same result that you get from the vacuum, which is just the identity, basically. And you can prove, in fact, rigorously prove that this thing is well defined. It gives you a finite number, doesn't depend on regularization. So this is nice. And I think I'm going to skip how you do that and just give you the result. So this is what comes out of asymptotic analysis of this, the integrals that come out there. So this is the Reni entropy of this combination of two bodies. It looks like this. So there is some UV divergent thing that doesn't depend on the distance between the two objects. And then there is a term that depends on the volume of the objects and on the distance to the fourth. So this was a bit surprising for me to find, but I could not argue with the integrals. When you do this kind of perturbation theory, usually you expect to find things that are go like 1 over r to the 6th or r to the 7th and larger distances. Here, for some reason, it turns out to be 1 over r to the 4th. I don't know how to explain it, but that's what it comes out to be. And another feature that you want to maybe notice here is that it comes with a minus sign. So if you want, this is the analog of the Casimir energy, if you want. So this is the Casimir entanglement entropy. And what you see is that there is a minus sign, which means that when you take the bodies and make them farther and farther away, actually the field entropy goes down. The other way around. When you take them closer together, the field entropy goes down. What this means is basically the following, is that if each of these bodies is just by himself, it can entangle, kind of fully entangled with the field, but once they become close to each other, there is interference effects, and if you want, some modes can lock in between these two guys and not interact with the field anymore. Okay, last statement I want to make is about this. Remember I talked to you about the difference between the A dot J and E dot P Hamiltonians. One can do a toy model where you consider the entanglement between two plates like this, but the plates are now coupled to the field through an E dot P coupling instead of A dot J. You can do this calculation in some limits, you can do it exactly, and the result is the following. This is the entropy, and this is the entropy per unit area of the plates. It goes like 1 over L in three dimensions, 1 of the L to the 6th. So this was also surprising to me because these two results are very different from each other. So remember we had, for the Reni entropy, we had 1 over L to the 4th. So if I kind of roughly estimate how does the behavior of the interaction between two bodies, two plates, say infinite plates, should go like, and I use the result for the that I got before, well, I would integrate out over small patches of these materials, and I would get something that goes like 1 over L to the 2nd, and not like 1 over L to the 6th. So it seems like the two couplings give very different results. I don't know why. I don't understand this, but this is the main outcome of this. So now, having said all that, let me just summarize. Well, tell you about the way I'm thinking about it now. In general, is it's a general question. So what is the if you have some action and there is some non-locality that sits in there, what does it basically mean? What does it mean in terms of the state of the field and from point of view of entropy? We run into this all the time when we do RG, basically. So whenever we do RG, we basically integrate out, say, high momenta states. And we generate terms in the effective action for the remaining modes. And then, well, if life is good, we can kind of get rid of all of the non-locality in time, of all of the higher powers of omega, and we get the Hamiltonian. But in this process, every time we threw out a dispersion, a temporal dispersion, what we did is basically we went from a state which is mixed into a state which is pure. From mixed state to Hamiltonian. So the interesting problem is, can one actually quantify it and find out how much information we throw out in every step like that we do RG? And this, well, it would be nice to make a connection between this and say, the C theorem, or newer version of it. I want to say that there is this recent paper where this author started to look at this problem and computed the entanglement in some kind of a perturbation theory for some simple field theories. Okay, so I'll stop here. Okay, this is dead, so I have to do it manually. So let me summarize. So the thing that you get if you use this this approach, you can compute the state of the electromagnetic field in matter. It seems to be in some complicated state which is not thermal. So the dielectric does not act as a good thermal bath for the electromagnetic field. And in fact, this is not completely surprising because, as you know, to actually thermalize an object, what you need is an infinite bath of harmonic oscillators, which has basically continuous spectrum. This kind of dielectric function that I considered is, you should think about the dipole that is pinned. It has a particular pinning frequency, and it does not serve as a good bath for the field, although there are infinitely many of them. But the field is also living everywhere. So the state is not thermal. Then we looked at this Casimir entanglement entropy. We saw that it goes like R over 1 over r to the fourth in 3D. And I think that's where I stopped. And now you can ask a lot of different questions about this problem. So one thing I did completely ignore is thinking about gauge freedom and how does that mix degrees of freedom. One should probably think about that. Can one measure any of it? Does the fact that the field is in a non-thermal state, does it even mean anything? Well, usually anything we compute in electrodynamics has to do with computing things at a given frequency. We compute response functions. Here, all the information is contained in equal time correlation functions. So it's kind of an instantaneous snapshot of the field, which we never actually measure. But you could, I guess you could try to think of how you could measure something like this. Is there any way of starting with a dielectric with an electromagnetic field and turning off the dielectric suddenly? If you turn off the dielectric, then the entropy of the field will not change. The state will evolve, but it will not, at least the entropy will not change. I don't know how to do that, but I can imagine all kind of things. What is the meaning of the relative entropy? So I don't really know, except that it's finite. And maybe the last question that you would maybe want to ask is, can you put in a dielectric function that will be thermalizing and which will really describe electromagnetic field in a thermal bath and how it would look like? Obviously, it will be K dependent. And so this is, you can ask is if this describes some simple material. OK, so I'll stop here.
Questions?
So if you start from non-interacting theory, then you can just coupled fields like fermions, whatever. Then the Wigner function or Husimi function is a Gaussian. So I can imagine that writing this Gaussian, integrating it over degrees of freedom you're not interested in, getting another Gaussian, then diagonalizing whatever you have an exponent and getting some effective spectrum, epsilon k, temperatures, whatever. I just wonder if you thought, and this can be connected to finite temperatures, of course. So I just wonder if you thought if this is sort of similar to what you're doing.
I guess I'm not sure exactly what you mean, what you suggest to do. But I guess since this is a Gaussian theory, all of these approaches are completely equivalent. And so for I guess you could ask what is the kind of instantaneous Wigner function that we would get, and what kind of density of field density we'll get from this Wigner function. I suppose you should get the same answer as here. How to get from it the spectrum, what is called the entanglement spectrum, I haven't thought about, but I'm sure one can do it.
I guess my point is that you can extend it to finite temperatures. Because with Wigner function, there's no problem.
Oh, yeah. Actually, even here, you can up to some boundary problems, you can extend it. Certainly, the simplest thing you can do is just take the dielectric function at finite temperature and also restrict all your two-point calculations to finite temperatures at equal time.
With regard to your third point, I just wanted to say that I know this is not what you did, but if you don't have the medium at all, but you just work out the relative entropy, the mutual entropy for a Gaussian field in 3D, then it also scales like r to the minus 4. So it doesn't change it very much, apparently, by integrating out the medium.
So again, if you take a free field and integrate out everything outside,
you calculate the usual
Okay, I should look at that. I don't know about
it. So for evaluating this Casimir entangled entropy between these two bodies, did you still use the dielectric the response function with Q equal to zero? Did you take that into account or not?
Yeah. So this is an explicit formula. Looks like this, So the formula for the dielectric is just 1/, so it's omega p squared divided by omega squared plus omega naught squared.
So I was just thinking that maybe this is related to the violation of the sum rule if you're still ignoring the momentum dependence of the response function.
So you would assume that you get corrections from that, but hopefully there are subleading corrections.
One last question.
Maybe just one more. Another thing you should take care of: this is not the entropy. There's this S of infinity, which is some large, maybe divergent quantity. It has no hour dependence, but when you're talking about relative objects, then you have to be careful about a whole bunch of rules that you have. For example, you know that for example, this kind of for example, if you do you're looking at the subadditivity of entropy. Once you're looking at differences between different entropies of different systems, this is no longer the case. It's only when you're looking at one system and you integrate out different parts. So I'm not sure how the sum rules come in here, but one should think about it, I guess.
So in classical physics, you often have second-order time derivatives. Coming back to this, what you discussed right in the beginning, when you have a first-order time derivative only, then you can only prescribe one initial condition and not two, and that means right. In classical physics you can't fix both ends of the integral.
Right.
In the variational principle. So this, what you discuss here, seems to fall in the same ballpark as your example gave of took a first order time derivative.
Yeah, it's exactly that. It's the question of computing. In this language, is the difference between only knowing field correlators and knowing field and momentum correlators. So the momentum correlators tell you something about the boundary condition with respect to what is the first derivative in time at your initial condition. So that's why you have to know both of them. It's the same as in a second order differential equation. It's the same problem.
Okay, so let's thank the speaker.
Can I make just a couple of very quick announcements? So there will be discussion at 2:45 optional about entropy. And I just want to again thank KITP and Joycelyn in particular for like real taking care of organization of this conference, which was wonderful. I also want to say that some of you, especially younger people, got some unexpected check, and for this we really have to explicitly thank ARO, like Peter and Paul in particular. They really provided additional help for this conference. And I would like to thank like everyone again for coming and participating.